This is a famous Confederate outlaw, actually. I think his name is Jim Anderson, but fairly typical Civil War era picture of a guy who is having his picture made. So he's going to put his hand up and all kind of occupies his space. A man should not sit, I'm told, with his knees together and his hands in his lap. That if he's going to command attention, he's going to fill up his space. So his arm needs to go on the next chair over and maybe cross his legs or do something like, and his arm should be out. So he takes up a little bit more space. What does a cobra do when it wants to get your attention? It flaps its ears or whatever that flap of skin is, right? And a real man should do the same thing, right? Yeah, so. All right. Jephthah becomes Israel's leader. This is chapter 11. We'll get as far as we can. This is a story that is opposite in the chronology of the book of Judges. We are now opposite of Ehud, the left-handed man. So it's the only place in the book of Judges where if you put them in a circle, we have major judge opposite major judge. Otherwise, it's always minor opposite major and so forth. There is one minor opposite minor also, but this is the only major opposite major. Jephthah opposite Ehud. Ehud known for his trickery. Remember, he was a lefty. That tricky man. And he strapped his side on his sword on his thigh so he wouldn't be caught and so forth. And we'll see if Jephthah also resorts to some trickery here. So Jephthah the Gileadite was a valiant hero. He was the son of a prostitute. And Gilead was his father. So he's from the tribe or the area of Gilead. Maybe even the family of Gilead from Manasseh. But the son of a prostitute. There are a couple of different words for wife and concubine. But this is a zona. This is a prostitute. That's the word in Hebrew. This is when in the story of Judah, right? After Joseph had been sold into slavery, Judah is harvesting and is getting the sheep in and so forth. And on his way home, he finds on the side of the road, this is after his wife dies, he finds a zona, a prostitute. But she's not a prostitute. She's actually his daughter-in-law. Because his sons have failed to marry and impregnate her and to get her a descendant. So she decides to trap him. So she finds the path he was going to take home and she sets up her little prostitute hut next to the side of the road and bats her eyelashes at him. And then remember, he doesn't have any cash. So she says, give me your seal and your ring. And he does. And then later on, he wants to cash that in, but she's gone. And he's like, well, at least he got something of value and I hope this doesn't turn out badly. And then she shows up pregnant at his house, his daughter-in-law. And he's going to put her to death. And then she produces the seal. Whose is this? Oops. She's a zona, a prostitute, and this Jephthah's mother, his brothers, he had plenty of brothers, but his mother was a prostitute. So father, traditional family, with traditional wives, but this guy was on the outside, which also kind of reminds us of the Abimelech story. Abimelech's dad, who was Gideon, had lots and lots of wives and sons. Remember, 70 sons. And Abimelech was the outsider there. He killed all of his brothers. Jephthah will do something different. The Jephthah story is going to be different.
So, you keep saying that they were on the outside. So if they were the child of a prostitute, they were not equal in the eyes of...
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When I was growing up, we still had a word for that. Yes, an illegitimate child.
With
Abraham. Right. But not with a not a child of a concubine or a wife, but with someone else, someone you're not married to at all. That's the relationship here.
So the difference between a prostitute and a concubine is that a concubine is part of that.
Of the family. She's being taken care of in the house.
She's just not a wife.
Or a secondary wife. I don't know exactly how to translate it best. But a prostitute is just a woman you pay to have sex with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's the main difference here. Gilead's wife also bore him sons, and when they grew up, they drove Jephthah out. So here it's the other way around. The brothers drive out this guy and said to him, "You will have no inheritance in our father's family because you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. Then some worthless men began to join up with Jephthah, went on raids with him. Again, not very different from Gideon, who collected worthless men and used them wisely. Abimelech collected worthless men and used them unwisely. David collected worthless men and used them wisely. Jephthah collects worthless men and uses them wisely. So he becomes a good commander with these bandits. What would, if this were the Robin Hood story, what would we call the worthless men? They would be the merry men. Sure, Robin Hood and his merry men. Yeah, that's... This morning, I recorded... I'm saving a couple things before the discs fail. Henry V. And before he becomes king, Hal, this is an actual historical king of England, got a bunch of outlaws together and hung out with them to learn what England was really all about. So he learned about England by robbing some of the noblemen and found out about them, wearing a mask and so forth, and then later on he becomes their king. But when he becomes king, he banishes all of his pirate friends, the ones who survive. He won't have anything. He won't be with them any longer. But he did learn about the kingdom and about the actual people, and not just about the court. So this is what Jephthah has done. Worthless men. Anashim Rekim, men who are empty, or renegades, I suppose. Okay. It was sometime later when the Ammonites made war against Israel. So this Ammonite raid, we've already seen the arrows and so forth. That happened after Jephthah was growing up. So he's around, and now he's grown up. Now he's all ready for battle when this has actually taken place. Okay? So we've kind of, the elements of the story are coming together now chronologically. When the Ammonites made war with Israel, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. They said to Jephthah, "Come be our leader so we can fight the Ammonites." So these years have gone by, and now they actually go to get him. Tob, or Tov, is the Hebrew word for good. The good land. I don't know where that would have been. But there's nice, very nice land north of Galilee. There's a little tiny extra lake up there that's the spring that supplies a lot of the Jordan River's water and so forth, called Lake Hule. Could that have been the land of Tob? I'm not sure. But whatever it was. Anybody have a study Bible with a footnote there about the land of Tob? Or do they not say anything at all? You got one?
The men of Tob were later allied with the Ammonites against David.
Okay, so that, not a where, but a what. So men of Tob were later allied with the Ammonites against David. That just suggests the same area to me. So, good. Thank you. But Jephthah said to the elders of Israel, "Didn't you hate me and drive me out of my father's house?" This suggests to me that at least a couple of the elders of Israel were his own brothers. You guys drove me out. Tommy, Bob, Tim, you know, whatever, or you know, whoever he was talking to. So, why then have you come to me now when you are in trouble? They answered Jephthah, that is true, but we are turning to you now. Come with us and fight the Ammonites, and you will be the leader of all who live in Gilead. Jephthah has just done something that is very interesting. He has stated the purpose of what he's going to do, and then I'm going to turn the page. I'm sorry. He's clearly identified, he has rehearsed his relationship with his brothers. This is our history, this is what happened in the past. Now they tell him, if you lead us, you'll be our Rosh, our head, whatever that means, leader, overlord. What could head also mean? King, maybe? After the war is over? And now Jephthah comes at them with this. If you are bringing me back to fight the Ammonites and the Lord gives them to me, I'll be your leader. And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, the Lord is our witness if we do not do as you say. So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead. They themselves make an oath that binds them with a curse. The Lord is our witness if we do not do as you say. What will happen to us if we don't do it? Then we're in the hands of the Lord. Now, these are the criteria. I'm laying this out for you because the commentaries often don't do this, but I noticed it and I thought I would point it out to you. This is the outline of what's called a suzerain vassal treaty. These exact four things. So first, he's identified, and the identification of the overlord has to be at the beginning, at the top of the suzerain or sovereign vassal treaty. This is their agreement. It was quite common in ancient times. Number two, he retells his relationship with his brothers and the Gileadites, and a retelling of his dealings with the vassal is vital to the treaty. It's supposed to happen this way, and that's exactly what he just did. And the third one, the agreement is said, if you lead them, you'll be their overlord or Rosh, and the stipulations spell out what the new relationship of the overlord and the subordinate's going to be. Am I going to be your general, your king, your what? Or am I just the homeowner and you're the window washer? Whatever it's going to be, this is what's going to happen. And then fourthly, he presents the blessing. If the Lord gives them victory, he'll lead them. And the curse. If they don't obey Jephthah, the Lord was witness, and the curses of God will fall on their heads, which is implied but not stated. But blessings and curses are the conditions of keeping the or breaking the treaty. This is the way this kind of a thing was done.
And
yes.
So the people knew that Jephthah was a God's kind of chosen leader, but they still kicked him out.
I don't know that they knew that he was.
But it looks like they do kind of sort of.
Well, now that they need him,
they've
picked him. As we have Gad, Manasseh, and Reuben. We have three armies. However many thousand men that was. But we don't have a general. But this guy has proved to be a good leader of men with this band of outlaws. And so what they've done is they've gone out into Sherwood Forest and found Robin Hood. And they've said, would you please lead all of England's armies? And he says, yes. He says, yes.
Probably needed
additional
men as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had all kinds of things to say about Robin Hood and King John and Richard the Lionheart. I'm not going to say any of it. I'm done. Okay. Except that play is the least loved or performed of all of Shakespeare's plays, King John. Did you know that? I've been trying to remember this week and test myself and test my memory. I give myself little memory tests every once in a while. And this one is, whenever I finish another Sudoku puzzle, I have to write down all 37 of Shakespeare's plays. It's actually not as difficult as you think. If you know that 10 of them are histories, you know, and 8 of those have the word Henry at the front, you know, the other ones have a Richard there, and so forth. The tough one is some of the tragedies we don't see very often, but King John is the least popular of all of them. There's a famous comedian back in the 50s who would joke that was his favorite play of all time. What was his name? Peter Sellers. You know Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther and so forth? He would joke that King John was his favorite play. Whatever. Sorry to go off like that. Do some of you know that when I, in my first college experience, my goal was to become a teacher of Shakespeare on the high school level? That's why I came to DMLC in the first place. That was what I wanted to do. The Lord had a different path for me, but that's what I wanted to do. Still have a great love for Shakespeare. Okay. I didn't read any of this yet, did I? Let's get back to the text, please. Jephthah rejects the Ammonite claims. Oh, this is great. This is leadership. Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the Ammonites asking, "What do you have against me that you have come to fight me in my land?" The king of the Ammonites, that's a question of strength, isn't it? I'm king, what are you doing? The king of the Ammonites said to Jephthah's messengers, "When Israel came from Egypt, they seized my land from the Arnon to the Jabbok and the Jordan. Now restore it peaceably." What have they just done? I think that today we call this fake news. They have lied about Israelite history. This is not what happened. But they make it sound like it might have happened. And what have we been learning? That the more you say something and the louder you say it, people will start to believe you after a while. And that's what the Ammonites try to do. Jephthah sent the messengers back to the king of the Ammonites, saying, "This is what Jephthah says. Israel did not take the land of Moab or the land of the Ammonites. But when they came out of Egypt, Israel went through the desert to the Red Sea and from there to Kadesh." Jephthah is retelling the story of the Exodus by saying, out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, to Kadesh. Kadesh is south of Judah. We're nowhere near Moab or Ammon, right? And then he goes on. "Then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying," this is Jephthah still telling the story. Don't get confused by the sending messengers. This is within the context of the story. "Please let us go through your land, O Edomites." But the king of Edom would not listen. "They also sent messengers to the king of Moab, but he refused. So Israel stayed in Kadesh." How long was Israel in Kadesh after asking the Moabites and the Ammonites for permission? 38 years. Yeah. God actually commanded Israel in Deuteronomy 2 not to harass or provoke the Ammonites because they were descended from Lot like the Moabites. So God commanded them, hands off the Ammonites. God gave them a whole string of enemies, right? But the Ammonites were not on the list. They're not on the shopping list. When I go grocery shopping in Sleepy Eye at Schutz's, there are some things I can't buy there. Right? It's a smaller grocery store, so that stuff is off the list. So there. I have to buy my boxed goldfish crackers at Walmart instead or whatever. So 18. "Then they traveled to the desert and around the lands of Edom and Moab." They went, this is the Jordan, and they went across and they had to go all the way around. What happened when they were the furthest east? The bronze snake. Aaron had just died, Miriam had just died, and now Moses faces the bronze snake incident without his brother and sister. They passed along the east side of the land of Moab and camped on the other side of the Arnon. The Arnon is one of those big rivers that feeds into the Jordan from the other side, from the east. And the Arnon Gorge is famous because it is so deep, hundreds of feet down to get to the river. And if you're up on top, this is where Jacob wrestled the angel long, long ago, and so forth. And that's where Israel camped, was on the precipice of the Arnon Gorge. But they did not enter into the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the boundary of Moab. So he's very careful to say, this is where we were. Not in your land, not in their land, but here in the no man's land. And between this area was an area that was claimed by an enemy of Moab and Ammon, the Amorites, at the time of the Exodus. And this is where they fought with the other king of the Amorites. Og was one. Who was the other one? Do you remember his name? Sihon. Sihon. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon. That's right here. Heshbon, not very far north of the Arnon Gorge. Israel said to him, please let us travel through your land to our own country. But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. Sihon called together all his troops, camped at Jahaz, and fought with Israel, a battle I've sometimes called the battle above the clouds, because they're so high up in the air above the Jordan there. Then the Lord, the God of Israel, handed Sihon and all his men to Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel took possession of all the land of the Amorites who lived in that country. They captured all the territory of the Amorites, from the Arnon to the Jabbok, and from the desert to the Jordan. So all that stuff that Ammon is claiming did not belong to Ammon ever. It was the Amorite territory. And can I illustrate this for you? It was as if, in American history, what if the Incas, that's that fuzzy green territory there, do you see what continent the Incas were a part of? What is that? South America. What if today the Incas came up to President Biden and said, you stole Texas and New Mexico from us. Give them back. Did the Incas ever possess anything north of the Panama Canal? No. So it's that kind of an argument, okay? It has nothing to do with geography or fact, okay? So the Incas never even got close to Mexico. So didn't I promise you all three North American countries in this class? Okay, there we are. But the Incas were not even part of Central America. They were a part of what today we call mostly what? Peru and Chile. Yeah, Peru and Chile. Maybe a little bit north of Peru. Is that Bolivia? A little bit north of there further. Anyway, our territory, I'm going to say, of like Texas and so forth, never part of the Inca territory. All right. Now, before I read this, can you tell me what you think of Chemosh, the god of the Ammonites? Of all of the false gods, does he kind of look like a grandpa with a bathrobe on in his easy chair? Also, where are his eyes? Many statues of Chemosh don't seem to have eyes. This statue of Chemosh is also missing something else. Arms. I'm a little bit nervous about that. The Ammonites were, of course, the brothers of the Moabites. The Moabites worshipped Moloch, or Molech, and Molech was a god that later kings of Israel sacrificed their children to. But this guy doesn't, it just looks like his arms are missing. It doesn't look like he maybe held children, it looks more like his hands would have been down on his knees. I just don't know what happened to the arms in this case, but they make me a little bit nervous. But this is what Jephthah says. Now, after the Lord God of Israel has driven out the Amorites before his people Israel, will you try to take possession? Why not take whatever your God Chemosh gives you? And we can have whatever the Lord our God gives to us. Remember that the Lord had said this kind of thing to the Israelites not long before? Why don't you ask your God, your false gods, for help? And now Jephthah just repeats that to the Ammonites here. Not a bad way of talking about it. We'll see whose God gives them what. Are you any better than Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab? Who did Balak sic on the Israelites in Moses' day? Balaam, the false prophet, right? Yeah. Did he ever quarrel with Israel or fight against them? And now, we're at the end of the time here almost. For 300 years, Israel has lived in Heshbon and Aroer and their surrounding villages, and then all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon. Why didn't you take them back during that time? You've had three centuries to take back villages, unwalled villages. Why haven't you taken them? Also, this is how I got the date for where we are in history. Okay? The book of Judges begins around what year? Say that again.
1100, that's what you said about.
This is 1100. Add 300 more, you're in the 1400s. In 1446 BC, the Pharaoh's name was Thutmose III. That's the date of the Exodus, 300 years ago. Now it's 300 years after the Israelites. Actually, 1406 is the entry, 80 years later, of the entry into Israel. That puts us at about 1106 in our text, 300 years later. There are just a couple of important post-hole dates where we get a pretty firm date on when things are happening in the Old Testament, and this is one of them. We have the ages of the patriarchs when they died. Joseph was 110, Jacob 147, 17 of those years spent in Egypt. Isaac died at 180, Abraham at 175. We also learn how old they were when they had their boys. Usually the guys were in their 40s, except Abraham, who was much older. Remember how old Abraham was? 99 and 100, yeah. So these are important dates for that chronology in Genesis. And then we get to the age of Moses. In each of the three important stages of his life, he was 40, 80, and 120. When he left Egypt, went back to Egypt, and got out again, and then when he died. And then you have a couple things. Caleb's age, when selected to be a spy, we know that. Jephthah's 300-year reference puts us to here, 1106 or so BC, for these closing chapters of the book of Judges. We know the date of the building of Solomon's temple, and the dates for the divided kingdom when the exiles went into Assyria and Babylon and the return from Babylon. Those are the big dates. I was maybe going to spend more time on that, but I think we'll just skip over it. But this reference to 300 years is a pretty important one in the chronology of the Old Testament, and I won't burden you with more than that. Okay? Let's just get to this last pair of verses before we get to the bad part of the chapter. He says, I have not wronged you, but you are doing me wrong by fighting against me. Let the Lord, who is the judge, decide today between the Israelites and the Ammonites. But the king of the Ammonites paid no attention to the message Jephthah sent him. So the end of the message summarizes the point. You're doing me wrong. I ain't done you no wrong. There's evidence to back up the case, evidence the king of the Ammonites could certainly check and to verify. What do we know about political leaders when they are shown to be wrong? They double down on the lie or on the mistake. There's a classic line in the movie Gettysburg when Robert E. Lee's commanding general, Tom Berenger, what's the actual general's name? Help me, Longbeard? Longstreet. Longstreet says to somebody else in passing before the battle, they're lamenting the cause of the Confederacy and how England, France, Europe cannot possibly come to the Confederacy's aid because the Confederates still had slavery. And Longstreet says what many people have said over the years, we should have freed the slaves, then fired on Fort Sumter. Remarkable words. Might have had a very different outcome in the war and in American history if that had taken place. But then he goes to say, but we're a lot like you British. We'd rather lose the war than admit the mistake. So that happens with our leaders once in a while. What was his name in Vietnam? Was it McNamara? Was our general who finally got pulled out, but it took a different presidency to pull us out finally of Vietnam after the mistake. That's all of our time today. We will get to the unfortunateest part of the story in all of Judges, Jephthah's vow and his poor little girl, next time. God bless you all. Thank you for letting me do this. You've been listening to Invisible Church, the Bible study podcast from St. Paul's Lutheran Church, New Ulm, Minnesota.